This is a Triple J podcast.
Hack. Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. How much do you know about quantum physics? Probably not something you're diving into on a Sunday arvo when you're trying to chill out. If you're anything like me, minimal. Maybe you are really good at science. You've always been fascinated in it and you do read a lot about it. Well, it's an area that's getting a lot of attention at the moment after Australia signed a deal worth almost $1 billion to build the world's first useful quantum computer. So why the hell are we spending so much money on this? How could this technology change the world around us? Well, later we're getting into this with an actual quantum physicist, someone who can break it down, and he's promised to make it easy for all of us to understand. I can't wait to get into that one. First, though, the university protests spreading around the world.
Hack. The weapons companies that our university has ties and connections to are being used directly on civilians.
On Triple J.
When a group of protesters set up an encampment at Columbia University in New York a couple of weeks ago, they probably never imagined that students around the world would be joining their demonstration within days, but they have. And things are really kicking off in the US. Protesters have set up camp in buildings, there's been violence, hundreds of arrests. And now this global movement has reached Australia. Today, police officers were called to Melbourne Uni as Jewish and pro-Palestinian groups faced off on campus. So what exactly is this all about? Well, Hack's Melbourne reporter Ariana Lachente has been looking into it.
Columbia Uni in New York, protesters inside one of the campus's main buildings, Hamilton Hall, unfurl a banner with the words Hind Hall. They say it's in memory of Hind Rajan, a six-year-old Palestinian girl killed in the war in Gaza. Some of these protesters have been here for 2 weeks, and there are heaps of similar camps, or encampments as they're being called, at other American unis too. But in New York in the last few days, riot police in full tactical gear and helmets were called to clear protesters out.
Approximately 300 people were arrested at Columbia and City College.
That's the mayor of New York, Eric Adams.
Students have a right to protest. There's nothing peaceful about barricading buildings, destroying property, or dismantling security cameras.
It's estimated there have been more than 1,600 arrests across nearly 40 colleges in the US. There are also violent scenes at UCLA on the West Coast. Yeah.
The life-threatening assault we faced last night is nothing less than a horrifying, despicable act of terror.
So, what do protesters actually want? They're demanding an end to the war in Gaza and calling on unis to basically cut financial ties with Israel or any companies who they say are profiting from the invasion of Gaza. And the movement has made its way to campuses here in Australia, in Sydney, Brisbane, Adelaide, Canberra, and Perth.
We've been protesting and advocating for the university to drop their ties with Lockheed Martin and several other weapons manufacturers that are directly implicated in Israel's assault on Gaza.
This is Reham. She's a student at Melbourne Uni and one of the organisers from the group Uni Melb for Palestine.
In inspiration by the encampment at Columbia University, that we'd start an encampment here. So our demands are still the same, to divest from those weapons manufacturers and to disclose what kind of research is being done at the university under the defence branch.
The encampment has been going since Anzac Day.
So we started with about 20 to 30 people. Now we have about 60 to 70 people staying overnight.
I spoke to some of the people there.
Yeah, we've been here since Thursday, sleeping in the cold, sleeping in the rain.
I've never done a solidarity encampment like this, not at all.
It's pretty vibey, pretty groovy. We've had people come in, share food, share stories. If there's a wholesome activity that you can think of, we've probably done it.
In a statement to Hack, Melbourne Uni said it welcomed debate and peaceful protest on campus, provided it did not extend to violence, threat, or intimidation. Today, groups including the Melbourne University Jewish Student Society and the Australian Union of Jewish Students held a counter-protest. They're demanding physical and psychological safety on campus and a right to express their identity on campus. Sarah Lupton is from Melbourne Uni's Jewish Student Society.
I think a big worry for Jewish students is the fact that they have been inspired by American universities, and we have seen escalations that go over the normal free speech threshold there.
Dozens of police officers showed up on campus today too, but say there weren't any arrests. I asked the students if they were worried that things might escalate.
The University of Melbourne is taking a bit of a different approach, where maybe they're trying to wait us out a little bit, call our bluff, hoping that we pack up before they have to do anything with police.
Hack on Triple J.
Arianna Lachente reporting there. Well, let's go back to where it all started, the US, to Columbia University in New York. Meghnad Bose is a journalism student at Columbia Uni. He also works as a journalist there and is covering these protests for students. Meghnad, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is the feeling like at your university this week at Columbia? Because things have really escalated over the last few days. Hundreds have been arrested over the past day. You're there all the time. What's it like?
You know, it's funny because everyone keeps asking us that. But the thing is, there are barely any students on campus right now. Access to Columbia University has been severely restricted. Only the undergrad students who live on campus are being allowed entry, and essential personnel of the university. Now, student journalists, designated student journalists who've been covering these protests, are this third sort of special group. We've been given entry and access to campus as well. But that's basically it.
So obviously the student journalists are playing a crucial role, because I've seen that media has been blocked, I guess, from going on campus as a bit of a safety measure, really. So a lot of the reporting is coming from students at Columbia. Did you see violence from police? Did you see really intense actions from police, some of the stuff that's been reported?
So I was actually right inside one of the main gates of Columbia University, and right outside the gates, there were a line of pro-Palestine protesters who had sort of lined themselves against the gate in an attempt to prevent the NYPD from entering campus from that gate. The NYPD proceeded to arrest the members who were there. So I saw that, and the NYPD was getting occasionally pretty aggressive in doing so, in removing some of these protesters who were pretty resolutely standing in front of that gate. After that, when the NYPD came in through the Amsterdam gates of Columbia University, there were some student protesters who were sitting near the backside of Hamilton Hall. And now the NYPD was pretty rough with these student protesters as well. And that's what we're hearing from other journalists who were around, that the use of physical aggression was pretty much on display.
I mean, New York officials have blamed outside agitators for hijacking a peaceful pro-Palestinian demonstration. What's your take on that?
I mean, it's very interesting that they've said that. And look, the NYPD has had ample time to not just arrest all these individuals who were inside Hamilton Hall and elsewhere. So they know the identities of the arrested individuals who were in their custody. And how difficult is it for the NYPD to actually verify and corroborate how many of these arrested individuals were Columbia University ID holders or Columbia University affiliates, and how many of them weren't? So instead of fueling this sort of endless speculation about whether they were outside agitators or protesting students, the NYPD should just come out and release the data. And I think that it's a disservice for them to not do that.
Are there students who are against these demonstrations who are saying this is disrupting our studies and we don't like what's going on?
Look, yeah, there are a certain section of students who have been opposed to the encampment. There have been a certain section of Jewish students who've said that they feel that the encampment make them feel threatened, make them feel unsafe. And they've pointed to incidents of anti-Semitism in and outside campus. Now, there are also a large number of Jewish students who were at the encampment and who've a big part of the protests in solidarity with Gaza. It is a real range of opinions. But yes, to answer your question directly, there is a group of pro-Israel Jewish students who have repeatedly stated that they do not feel safe
Meghnad, you're speaking to students every day. What are they telling you about how long these demonstrations could continue?
Columbia University President Minoush Shafiq, in her email to the NYPD, sort of calling in for the NYPD to come in on Tuesday evening and arrest these students. The president also requested the NYPD to stay on campus, to retain a presence on campus till at least 17th May, which is 2.5 weeks from now, which is also after the commencement ceremonies or the graduation ceremonies for the outgoing class, of which I'm a part of as well. So the protests are definitely not going to stop. That's what it seems like. However, whether they can be held on campus with this sort of police presence around till at least the 17th of May, as per the university president's email, it seems unlikely.
And I mean, we're seeing protests as well at university campuses in Australia even. I'm wondering, do the Columbia students know just how widespread these demonstrations have become?
I wouldn't happen to know if the protest organizers or the protesters at Columbia specifically know about the Australian campuses where the protests are happening, but they do definitely know that their sort of encampment has started similar modes of sit-in protests in different parts of the world. What they also know, and this is based on certain videos that have been shot in Gaza and shared with online and with the protesters, they've seen, for example, a video of children in Gaza thanking them for their support. And I've seen some protesters refer to that as sort of incredibly motivating. Keep remembering why they're protesting or what the real reason for their protest is, what the demands or the driving force behind their protests is.
Well, look, it's definitely something that is going to continue to make headlines, I'm sure, at universities around the world. Thank you very much for giving us some insight into what it's like in New York at the moment and at Columbia University. Journalism student Meghnad Bose in New York, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And on the text line, someone says, it wasn't Jewish versus pro-Palestinian protesters at the University of Melbourne today. The Palestine camp is full of Jewish students. And yeah, like Meghnad just said, it's important to remember that these encampments full of people from all different backgrounds, beliefs, it is something that is continuing to kick off and we're starting to see it more and more universities in Australia. So we're going to make sure we keep you across it.
Hack! And just like a light bulb transforms society, quantum computers have the potential to impact so many aspects of our lives.
On Triple J.
AI has been shaking up the tech world for a while. It's all we've been hearing about. We've talked about it heaps. It's infiltrated our lives already. In the last year specifically, everyone's been thinking, how's this going to affect my job, the way I live my life? What is the next big thing in computing and tech, though? Well, some of the biggest tech companies in the world are in a race to build the first useful quantum computer. It'll be the most complex machine ever built, and there's at least a chance Australians can do it. And to try to make that happen, the government's made a huge investment to try to make sure the world's first useful quantum computer is created by Australians in Australia, perhaps in Brisbane. In a bit, we're going to unpack what all of this means with a quantum physicist. Get your head around it all. But first, here's Angel Parsons.
It's going to be part of everyone's life.
Huge computer processing power.
We revolutionise the way we do computing, the way the world operates.
Just hack nature, do the stuff that she's doing all the time and use it for our advantage.
Crack some of the big problems, not even the strongest supercomputers today can do.
The overachieving wonder child that tech companies around the world want to be the first to create, the quantum computer.
So there's a worldwide race to build these, to build the new industry of quantum computing, because there's really important problems in technology, in industry, in science that we can't solve at the moment with normal computers.
And there are high hopes that race will now be won in Brizzy. The federal and Queensland governments are each investing $470 million into developing the world's first useful quantum computer. Yep, almost $1 billion combined. For context, it's a tad more than the extra cash the federal government yesterday announced it would spend over 5 years to combat gender-based violence. So, what is this tech that taxpayers have just invested in?
A quantum computer is a computer that solves problems that we can't efficiently solve at the moment with normal computers, using all the aspects of quantum mechanics.
Where a regular computer runs on bits, ones and zeros, a binary, these computers use qubits, a kind of mystical, magical bit of quantum information that can kind of be a one, a zero, or both at the same time. And it's going to take up a lot of room. Professor Andrew White from UQ's School of Maths and Physics says it's not going to look like your laptop.
Okay, it's going to be the size of a warehouse, like the kind of warehouse you'd see out near an airport. It's going to be filled full of high-tech equipment that's being cooled by cryogens down near absolute zero.
Now, I've been saying they want to build the first useful quantum computer. That means it'll be fault-tolerant and free from the errors and instabilities that make quantum computers impractical currently. The company that's received 1 billion big ones in grants, loans and share purchases is tech startup PsiQuantum, and they reckon they'll have it built by 2029.
It's going to be the most complex machine ever built by humanity.
This is Dr. Kathy Foley, Australia's chief scientist.
The Australian research community is very excited by this because it's showing that the government is seeing that when they're ready to make those big investments to make something truly happen rather than just nibble around the edges, which has happened in the past.
PsiQuantum was founded by two Aussie researchers in Silicon Valley, so a US company.
This process has been clouded in secrecy.
And there have been some question marks over the process and whether Aussie companies are actually going to benefit at all. Here's Shadow Government Services Minister Paul Fletcher.
There was no public transparent expression of interest process. Why has the government chosen to allocate this very large amount of money to a company that's not based in Australia, it's based in the US? Yes, some of its founders are Australian.
Here's what Minister for Industry and Science, Ed Husic, has to say about the company.
Professor Jeremy O'Brien, in particular, some of his work is the most cited in quantum research in the planet. They left our shores because effectively they didn't think that we'd had an interest or a desire to back this type of technology. And now these Australians want to come home to ensure that we can become a tech manufacturing powerhouse. It is huge.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Angel Parsons with that update. So interesting. Angel did an excellent job of explaining. But I kind of want to know more. The potential of all of this. So I've brought in a big gun. Professor Michael Biersick is a quantum physicist and the director of the Quantum Control Lab at the University of Sydney. And he's with us right now. Professor Mike, thanks for coming on Hack.
Great to be here. I'll point out I'm also the CEO of QControl.
Oh, wow. Okay. You got a lot of credentials, Mike.
I get around, yeah.
The way quantum computing is described is pretty crazy sometimes. Like I was reading a few articles on the back of this big announcement that we've heard from the government over the past week. And, you know, the Queensland Treasurer described this venture as Australia's moon landing. I've heard you say in previous interviews, the realisation of quantum technology represents one of the most profound transformations in the way humanity builds things in history. Why is it that important?
Well, we've been through various phases of our technology development. And really, the way we've always built stuff has been from starting with big collections of stuff, right? I talk about this in my TED Talk, which I understand you listened to not long ago. But what's changing is that we're starting to look at nature at its most fundamental levels, looking at individual particles of matter like atoms or individual particles of light called photons. And when we start to build with those, we get access to totally different behavior, totally different rules. That's this domain of quantum physics, which when you start to isolate these individual fundamental particles, these individual fundamental aspects of light or matter, the new rules allow us to do new things. And that's what gets really exciting. We're suddenly able to access the physics that's been hidden from us for years. And without the negative connotations, it's not dissimilar in spirit to the way we unlock the power of the atom, right?
Wow. So there's all this investment research going on into quantum technology. Obviously, we've just heard about this announcement that was made. the company at the center of it, it's an American company that Australia's invested in. So I guess what's the benefit for Australia if they're successful?
For a little bit of background, the idea is this company founded by a couple of Australians who've lived abroad for a very long time and founded their company in the United States are now coming back. There are great things that come from it associated simply with the fact that the government is saying out loud that this is a priority area of technology, that this is the kind of bet that's worth making as a government. Now, for so long, we've heard quite a lot of hand-wringing. Governments would say, well, we can't pick winners. We can't favor any individual. We'll only, you know, take the average approach. That's quite boring. It's really exciting for them to say, nope, we're going to do something big. Now, in this particular case, it's an American company that's going to be setting up shop in Australia. We're very excited. I know the founders personally very well, and many members of the team were excited to have them onshore. The next step is for the government to build on that.
So if we talk about a quantum computer, why haven't we been able to build a usable one to date? Like, what's been the barrier? How long have we been trying to do this? How is it different to anything else?
You know, this is an area where there's a lot of misconception. There are quantum computers out there. We have built them. You can use one right now, right after I get off this interview. You can log on to a real quantum computer from the likes of a company like IBM or Rigetti or IonQ or a whole range of other companies, many of whom started from university research and became companies. Now, these are very difficult to build because the fundamental building blocks, they're called quantum bits or qubits. An analogy with the bits of information that we have in regular computers. Those qubits are very delicate and they tend to break. They tend to be interfered with by the environment. And that just means that the machine stops working. So you try to process some information, it just breaks. There is a lot of effort around the world to try to overcome this problem. Now, my company, QControl, is the world's leading specialist in fixing this problem and stabilizing the hardware. But it's still a major challenge to build bigger and bigger and bigger systems. So bigger machines mean you can do more, just like more powerful microprocessors meant you could do more.
So what kind of things are we talking about? Like, what if you looked ahead a few decades from now, what kind of things could we be relying on quantum computers to fix for us or to help us in society?
Right. Very important. Don't think of quantum computers as a replacement for conventional existing or what we call classical computers. They're an add-on and they allow us to solve some problems that just by the way the math works, they're really, really hard for regular computers, for the computers we have today. Now, some of them sound a little bit mundane, but are extremely important, extremely high impact. How do you make a transport schedule? How do you schedule the buses and the trains so you don't sit on the platform for 30 minutes longer than you need to? How do you optimize that schedule? It's actually really hard. And the companies that do this will literally have supercomputers crunching for 48, 72 hours just to come up with a schedule for a city like Sydney.
Really?
It's an amazingly hard problem. Same thing with other logistics optimization problems, like how DHL or FedEx or UPS, how they route the delivery vehicles. These are really hard problems, and there's a huge amount of time and effort put into those. It doesn't sound like much, but all of us rely all the time on transport schedules and logistics. You know, when we had supply chain disruptions around COVID, like it really sucked. And so we start with those problems. But as we look forward, how do we design new drugs? How do we actually protect information? The original use case for quantum computers, the original application that was proposed in the mid-1990s was to break the encryption that's behind public key encryption systems, right? So it's anytime you go in your browser and it says HTTPS, that security S comes from a math problem. And it's just hard for regular computers, but it's known to be easy or relatively easy for quantum computers.
I want to get into that in a bit and to the encryption stuff because I find that fascinating. I mean, could it also help with, you talked about some of the things that might seem mundane to people like transport schedules, but bigger problems of our time, like climate change, for example, is there scope for it to help in that sense with technology?
It sounds maybe surprising, but it's very, very hard to design a material to your specifications. I want a material that conducts electricity and is purple and is hard but not brittle. Now, if we can come up with new materials, if we have a quantum computer whose behavior mimics the quantum processes that we want to calculate, it could could, lots of qualifiers here, it could be a path to solving this problem, to design materials that do what we want. Now, that's really cool because we use crazy exotic materials in all sorts of things like the batteries that we build or efficient photovoltaics or materials that allow you to transmit energy over very long distances with no loss, no heating up. If you can crack this materials problem, it opens up a range of major impacts in climate science. I want you to imagine this. Imagine you could put wind turbines thousands of miles away, thousands of kilometers away, anywhere you wanted in the middle of the ocean, and then just pipe the energy anywhere else in the world, or solar panels in the middle of the desert where there is very little life, very far from population centers, pipe the energy thousands of kilometers to where the population centers are and have no loss, right?
Imagine. So we're talking about things like superconductors, right?
That's exactly right. Okay. It's a topic that got a lot of attention last year because maybe the people thought we had perhaps found this special superconductor that worked at regular temperatures, room temperatures. It turned out to be a bit of a furphy, but that idea of being able to actually crack the design problem. How do I design a material with the properties I want? That is still in the remit of what you could do with quantum computers.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Professor Michael Biersek, a quantum physicist, a very smart man, CEO of Q Control, about quantum computers and the whole range of possibilities going forward. Mike, is there a dark side here? Because I guess with all technology, AI is obviously the example that everyone talks about. We're all really excited in the beginning and then the attention turns to, oh, this thing could destroy us. Mm. Is that a real concern with quantum tech? Because what you were talking about before with encryption and cracking codes and things, that seems like it could have a really negative side if it got into the wrong hands.
I suppose my view is anything useful can be weaponized. A stick can be weaponized, a screwdriver can be weaponized, a computer can be weaponized, and certainly a quantum computer can be weaponized. And there is definitely a lot of concern about this from governments around the world. It's a very interesting circumstance that governments, like Australian government, use a legislative technique called an export control, right, to prevent you from sending technology of a particular class to the wrong hands. And there are all sorts of things that are export controls, weapon systems, you know, things that go on, missiles, all sorts of stuff. As best we understand, the likely export controls that are coming to quantum computers will be the first time that something is export controlled before it's built.
Wow.
Right? So there really is a lot of concern about this. I think the reality, though, is that it's misplaced. In quantum computing, it really seems like people simply say, oh, but it's quantum, right? And then they throw up their hands and say, well, it must have bad sides. We don't have any real insights into that. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to wait for the bad things to be developed to consider these things. I do think there is a bit of a preemptive move because of the, like, you know, in air quotes, spooky aspects of quantum. The more something is both lauded for how impactful it can be and difficult to understand, the more people freak out. And yeah. I think we're a little bit in freak out mode right now.
Okay. Well, let's switch the focus from freak out mode to inspiration mode.
Inspiration mode.
What about the economy? Like, if we talk about Australia going forward, jobs.
This is a generational opportunity to deliver pride and prosperity to all Australians. This is a topic that brought me from the United States to Australia about 14 years ago. It brought many of my colleagues from North America here because there was an extraordinary research strength. But this is not just for the people like me who have PhDs in quantum physics. It's not just for the specialists who have built their entire careers developing this technology. It really is for everybody because this is something with profound potential impacts in the computing sector, as we've been talking about, but also in the defense sector where I work quite a lot of Q Control in sensing. How do you navigate if you're underwater and you don't have a GPS signal? How do you detect underground tunnels? How do you fight against drones that are being sent in from enemies? These are all things accessible with quantum technology. And in order to realize all of this opportunity, we need participation from everyone. We need people from every different background to be contributing to the growth of our sector. We need people in design, in user experience, in software engineering and business and marketing, I do think it is potentially what comes after mining. We've relied on digging up dirt and shipping it overseas for so long. And it's well documented that Australian, what's called economic complexity, has fallen off a cliff. It is the lowest economic complexity of the OECD nations. What we're looking forward to next is actual investment in the local sector. This new level of economic complexity, being an exporter of the most high-tech stuff you can possibly imagine and having it largely built in Australia. It's a great, exciting vision for the future that doesn't involve destroying the environment in the same way.
Wow, it's huge to think about. And a lot of people listening now, you've blown their minds, I'm sure. It's a crazy potential. We appreciate you breaking it all down for us. Professor Michael Biersick, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hack on Triple J.
A lot of people with thoughts on this one. Someone says, where are we getting all the money from? Every state is broke AF. Someone else, Amanda, let's hope they don't use it for war. And another person says, look, we've seen AI make huge progress on the sort of problems that quantum computers will potentially solve, like drug discovery. How much could AI eat into the case for quantum computers? It's an interesting question. And seeing all of these technologies play out, coexist, we're going to be living it, so we may as well talk about it. That is all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll be back tomorrow. I'll catch you then. See ya. Hack.